This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. It's a controversial move, but now most of the Eastern Seaboard is open to offshore energy exploration. Today we talk to experts about what that may entail. Just last week, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management issued a record of decision that allows geological and geophysical survey activities for the purpose of updating data on offshore resources. Acting Director for the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, Walter Cruikshank, says the surveys will update information that's four decades old.
There were seismic surveys that were taken back in the 1970s and early 1980s, but that was using older technologies that could not see as far underneath the seabed as current technologies.
The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management approved a variety of methods for conducting the surveys, including electromagnetic, gravity, and remote sensing surveys. One of the more controversial methods uses seismic air guns that shoot a pulse into the water in search of oil and gas deposits deep in the ocean floor.
Those are conducted by using compressed air guns, if you will, that are towed behind ships. These are cylinders filled with compressed air, and when that air is released, they create a sound wave. And the sound wave will penetrate the seabed and reflect off of the layers of rock beneath the seabed. The seismic vessels are towing hydrophones that will listen for those reflected sound waves and use the data from those sound waves to map the subsurface.
The blasts of air in the water, comparable to the volume of dynamite, will occur every 10 to 15 seconds and can continue for months at a time. Some worry using high-volume air guns could impact marine mammals and fish who rely on their sense of hearing in order to survive. Associate Professor of Animal Medicine at North Carolina State University, Dr. Craig Harms.
High-energy noise has been associated with strandings of particularly deep-diving dolphin and whales, like beaked whales, probably because of a behavioral effect that it modifies their surfacing and diving intervals and their dissolved gases in their blood, and so they can develop a Benz-like condition.
Harm says hearing loss can also occur in dolphins and whales in the vicinity of seismic surveys. The explosions of air generate sound pressure levels in excess of 180 decibels. To put that into perspective, a jet engine registers under that at 140 decibels. Humpback whales and the endangered right whale depend on echolocation to communicate and navigate their environment. The low frequency of the seismic pulses, which are in the 100 to 200 hertz range, is the same frequency range that the whales use. In addition to whales and dolphins, certain fish species and sea turtles may also be impacted by the seismic air gun surveys.
I've done some work over at the Duke Lab. Wendy Peniak, as a graduate student there, did a lot of hearing studies on sea turtles, and we don't really know what effect those noises might have on their behaviors, but we know that it's going to be active in the range where they hear.
Despite possible impacts to a variety of ocean creatures, offshore energy exploration holds possibility for oil and gas resources that could translate into jobs and revenue for the state. In order to reduce or eliminate impacts to marine life, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management issued their record of decision that implements the strongest practicable safeguards to protect humans, marine life, and coastal environments while moving forward with the geological and geophysical surveys. Acting Director of BOEM Walter Cruikshank thinks the exclusion zone around the vessel will act to protect marine life from survey activity.
That zone is designed to make sure that no marine mammals can come within at least 500 meters, could be farther depending on the sound levels, but it's designed to make sure that the animals will not be exposed to a sound level that could cause injury.
Visual monitoring by trained protected species observers will be required before and after seismic surveys. If an animal is spotted, seismic air gun activities will be shut down. Associate Professor of Animal Medicine at NC State University, Dr. Craig Harms, says the problem is that observers only see animals from the surface.
Some of the whales and dolphins that are particularly affected by some sound acoustic events in the past are the beaked whales, which spend so much time at depth and very little time at the surface that you just might not see them.
Associate Professor at the Duke Marine Lab, Doug Nowacek, agrees.
The boats are required to have marine mammal observers, but it does no good in fog or rain or night or what have you.
Nowacek studies how sound travels through the water and how marine animals use sound to communicate and explore their environment. He says the 500-meter exclusion area is not enough because low-frequency explosions travel through the water with relative ease.
There was a report a couple of years ago documenting seismic signals being recorded on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, so halfway across the Atlantic Ocean, from surveys that were taking place off Nova Scotia and Brazil. And some 4,000 kilometers away from the source, those signals were still detectable.
Studies show that exposure to sound pressure levels of 160 decibels can cause animals to be behaviorally disturbed. When those levels rise in excess of 180 decibels, there's a potential for injury. According to Noacek, sound pressure levels from the air guns could still be 180 decibels, even 1,500 meters away. That's three times the distance the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has set as a minimum requirement for the acoustic exclusion zone. Furthermore, Noacek says it doesn't take extreme sound levels to cause damage, just prolonged exposure.
One of the things we worry about is the actual physiological stress of being in a noisy environment all the time. And we have some signs that marine mammals in particular do experience stress responses in noisy environments.
In order to mitigate the impact to marine mammals, such as dolphins and whales, the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management outlines in their record of decision that passive acoustic monitoring is required during air gun surveys. This is done by placing stationary or towed hydrophones in the water to listen for vocalizations. Also, a 40-kilometer separation distance is required between vessels simultaneously conducting seismic surveys. The Bureau of Ocean Energy Management is also prohibiting geological and geophysical surveys during certain times of the year to protect the endangered right whale migration patterns. Acting Director of BOEM, Walter Cruikshank, says the record of decision doesn't authorize survey activities. Rather, it establishes a framework for how permit applications will be considered.
In addition to our review of these surveys, the National Marine Fisheries Service will also be conducting a review under the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And under that act, the National Marine Fisheries Service cannot provide authorization for those surveys unless they determine in advance that those surveys will not adversely affect any marine mammal species.
Since offshore energy exploration is allowed along the eastern seaboard, companies can now apply for permits to conduct survey activities from the inner edge of federal waters to 403 miles offshore. Cruikshank says the permit review process can be lengthy, so he doesn't expect seismic testing to begin until at least spring of 2015. Getting oil and gas from offshore sites may not be far off, but Associate Professor of Animal Medicine at NC State, Dr. Craig Harms, says it's not too early to start thinking about oil spill containment.
We have to be sure that we've got structures in place to contain and respond to any potential spill. And it might seem right now that that's way in the distance and we don't really need to worry about that yet, but really need to start putting mechanisms in place now to deal with that.
Duke Marine Lab's Doug Noacek is mostly concerned with the long-term ramifications of conducting seismic surveys and the effects it would have on marine animals.
There may be two or three or more surveys over those areas by different companies, or even by the same company, paid for by a different oil company. And these repeat surveys means that you could have the same block of water shot by seismic multiple times so that the different companies get essentially the same data. And what's more, if we do get downstream to the development of oil fields, those areas are going to be reshot by seismic every some number of years, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, as they monitor the production of those wells.
Noacek and Harms may have valid concerns. According to reports from the National Resources Defense Council, air gun surveys have dramatically depressed catch rates of commercial fish species across thousands of square miles of ocean, leaving fishermen in Norway and other parts of the world to seek compensation for their losses. In the span of 5 years, the solar industry in North Carolina has grown from nearly non-existent to fourth largest in the nation, behind only titans of the sun, California, Arizona, and New Jersey. And the pace is accelerating, with solar capacity set to be more than double in the state, at least this year. The state's powerful electric utilities are pushing changes that could blot out the industry in North Carolina. WFAE's Ben Bradford reports.
This is a solar farm in Mount Airy. Okay, it's sheep on a solar farm in Mount Airy. Across 25 acres, dark blue solar panels made of glass the thickness of a windshield catch the sun. As for the sheep...
They maintain the grass. I mean, it's a farm.
Joel Olson is managing director of solar company O2 Energies in Cornelius.
We have a local farmer that puts sheep on all the farms, and then the sheep roam, you know, free pasture, and then Whole Foods buys them. And they're the only North Carolina sheep in North Carolina Whole Foods.
Olson cut the ribbon on O2's first solar project in 2011, and this one in 2012. Today, it has 7, with another 10 under development. A combination of falling technology costs, favorable tax credits, and a sunny climate has helped North Carolina solar companies word a life. That's literally the sound of energy, collecting and converting at the heart of an O2 solar installation. From here, it's sent into the electric grid. Duke Energy has to buy the power. A federal law, passed after the 70s oil crisis, requires it. The idea was to create space for small companies in a sector dominated by monopolies and to encourage renewable energy. But Duke Energy spokesman Randy Wheelis says there's a problem.
The way the rules are right now is that if you bring on a solar farm under 5 megawatts, we have to take that energy whether we really need it or not.
So any project under 5 megawatts, generating enough power for roughly 500 homes, gets paid what it would cost the utility to provide the energy. Over 5 megawatts, there's no set rate. The utility can negotiate price.
We'd like to lower that threshold to allow us more flexibility to negotiate contracts in hopes that we can get better price for the customers.
The State Utilities Commission is reviewing its implementation of the law, and Duke and Dominion Power want it to set a threshold 200 times lower, the minimum. O2's Olson and many solar advocates say that would have dire consequences.
It would effectively kill the industry in North Carolina.
Nearly all solar projects in North Carolina use the set rate. John Morrison of Stratus Solar says his company would prefer to build larger farms, but needs the certainty the rate provides.
It allows us to have a very predictable schedule for our projects because we don't have to introduce the uncertainty of the negotiation process.
And that negotiation process is uncertain. State numbers show that of more than 60 qualifying projects over 5 megawatts, only 3 reached an agreement. Utilities also want to cut the maximum length of contracts from 15 years to 10, which could drive away funding.
We certainly wouldn't entertain financing, and I don't think many banks would.
Peter Pequeño is the chief lending officer at Surrey Bank and Trust in Mount Airy, where he's financed 5 projects.
They would pretty much drive anybody that wants to provide any type of solar power out of business because the economics don't work. You can't recover your cost, and you can't earn a decent return on your investment.
The utilities say the longer contracts let solar companies lock into rates when energy prices are high. Duke's Randy Wheelis.
Developers will come in when the trend line looks good for them, and when the trend line starts to look not so good, they don't come in. So the risk of overpaying is kind of borne by the customers.
So Duke argues shrinking the contracts will protect ratepayers. Jim Warren of environmental group NC Warren argues the company has a larger agenda.
Solar power is cutting into profits, and Duke and a few other utilities around the country have been working very hard to stop that process.
When Duke generates power, it earns a return approved by the Utilities Commission, which includes the cost of building its plants. When private developers generate that power, the company makes no money. And the additional capacity could actually hurt future revenues by pushing out the need to build more plants. But Wheelis of Duke Energy says there's no attack.
You know, this is not Duke trying to, you know, throttle solar in North Carolina. I mean, we're very active purchasers, but we still want to make sure we craft the rules going forward correctly to meet our needs and our customers' needs.
Wheelis points out companies have applied to develop 10 times the state's current solar capacity, perhaps more energy than we need right now, and Duke would have to buy it. As for the Utilities Commission, it's not clear what it will decide. The public staff, a state body appointed to represent ratepayers, has recommended no change. Often, the commission will approve a settlement between the utilities and the staff. O2's Olson cautions the decision will impact far more than the solar industry.
All the electricity that we use today comes from an infrastructure we put in place 50 years ago or more. All of those power plants are going to have to be retired and replaced.
Whatever gets built over the next few years will power us well into the middle of the century.
That was WFAE's Ben Bradford reporting. Tomorrow night, the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh has a special combination entertainment event featuring a screening of Oscar-winning documentary 20 Feet from Stardom that follows a live performance with one of the film's main stars, highly praised and often used background singer Lisa Fisher. She has a long career backing artists like the Rolling Stones, Aretha Franklin, Beyoncé, Tina Turner, Nine Inch Nails, Sting, and more. And as Mac McKee learns, even after some solo success, Lisa Fisher's biggest passion is not for the spotlight, but to live in the melody.
Lisa, did you begin singing at an early age?
I did. I think I always sang. It was just sort of what was going on in my household. There was always music around. It's just like, I want to sing. I want to sing the rest of my life. I like this. This is fun for me.
Now you are primarily known basically as a background singer, but in 1991, you had a hit single entitled How Can I Ease the Pain? Now, did you expect that song and its subsequent album, So Intense, to become as big as they did?
You know, Mac, I never expect much of anything. I just sort of kind of follow the flow. I was thankful and you know, that it did as well as it did.
Were you primarily concentrating on a solo career at that time?
No, actually, I wasn't really concentrating on it. It's kind of funny because the record company would look at me like, you're going on tour again. You're not going to be home to record your own record. You know, they would just thought I was insane, and I'm sure on some levels I was. But I was focused on making music, but I wasn't in a rush to finish anything or to try to figure out what being an artist means, you know?
Does that mean that you were more comfortable performing live and performing with others than you were in a studio setting?
I was comfortable with both. Oh, I have a lot of friends who did a little bit of both, and now it's not so much studio work as there used to be. So I'm hoping that changes.
A lot of times solo singing is like, if you want to make an analogy, but like being at the brightest color in a painting or like acting, it would also be like maybe going from the leading lady to being the character actress. Do you find you have more freedom, say, performing in the background?
I think singing background is structured. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a freedom unless you're doing it for Nine Inch Nails. You know what I mean? There's a certain kind of freedom of expression. The background is something, you're backing someone up, you're supporting them, you're the rock for them to lean on. So it needs to have some kind of structure and some surety, something that they can rely on so that they can sort of be free to be the artist and do what they need to do. So there is structure, but I'm free to feel it in any way that I choose. So that always brings and breathes new life into the experience every time I do something live.
You mentioned Nine Inch Nails. Who are some of the performers that you've appeared with over the years?
Luther Vandross for many years, the Rolling Stones for many years, Chaka Khan for maybe a tour or two, Nine Inch Nails, Tina Turner for maybe two tours. Oh, God. And the Crystals when I first started.
And I heard somewhere maybe Sting as well, too.
Yes, of course. But, you know, it wasn't necessarily a tour as much as it was like a project. It was on a winter's night, and it was for his Christmas release. And it was in Durham where he grew up, and it was just really beautiful, very, very special project.
You've appeared with so many varied performers for what you've just told me. Is every night singing with a different performer, or maybe being on tour with a certain performer, is that like being on a different adventure, kind of knowing that you might change the form of a song around from performance to performance?
Yeah, sometimes it does change, and it is an adventure because, you know, the artist is free to be. They're free to fly. They're free to do what they want to do. And so you kind of have to hold on to the wheel of the race car, you know, and just kind of you know, get taken on. You get taken on this ride with them, along with the audience, you know. That, to me, is exciting. Because you always have to watch them and listen, you know. It's like you're listening in a watchful manner, you know.
So after all of these years of performing with so many varied artists, what was your inspiration for the journey that finally became this Oscar-winning documentary, 20 Feet from Stardom?
Yeah, I was approached by Gil Friesen, who is the producer of the film. It was his idea, and I met him through, it was basically because of Sting, because his manager, Kathy Shanker, called me and said, oh, there's a guy named Gil Friesen that wants to talk to you about doing a documentary for Background Singers. So I was like, oh, that's sweet, you know, because I didn't think very much of it, because it was a new experience. I didn't know what to think. And so she went on to explain who Gil Friesen was, and I met with him, and he was just magical, lovely, classy, full of life, full of wonderment. And so he's like, yeah, I saw you, you know, with Sting, and it made me wonder, what is it like for Background Singers? I think there's a story there. And so, you know, we just kept in contact, and this was probably around July of 2010. And then he found Morgan and Neville, and we started filming, and then Morgan was just like on a whole nother plate. Just that whole journey for me was, it was beautiful to be able to share it with all the other singers, whether they sing background or not, but everyone that sings, you know, it was an amazing journey for me. It was interesting to kind of look back on the little, you know, things that I've done, and because I don't tend to really look back so much on what I do. I just try to stay in the present moment and keep moving forward.
Without giving away too much, because we want people to be surprised when they come see you on the 26th, can you give us a little bit about what the format of the show looks like?
I will be interpreting and reimagining songs that people know. Probably won't do a whole lot from my own record because I'm trying to move forward as a songstress, as somebody who lives in the melody. And so my main focus of the show is to connect with people. I want the melody to be the backdrop of that connection.
Tomorrow's performance with Lisa Fisher is a ticketed event, part of the museum's outdoor summer concert series. Details are available online at ncartmuseum.org.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. It's late July and it is hot. The glare from the sun is amazing when you're out in the yard. And you can feel its heat even from the indoors when you walk by an exposed window, can't you? Guess what? There's something you can do in the garden that will deal with all these hot summer issues for generations to come. Let's think about putting some trees in your yard that can provide shade. I know you think that trees don't grow fast enough to make a difference for you if you plant them now, but it's actually pretty amazing how quickly a tree can grow. Think about what a tree can do for you and your family in the future. First of all, of course, it can reduce air temperature by blocking direct sunlight off your house itself, off windows that absorb lots of heat, maybe off an adjacent driveway or porch. A tree could even provide a shady place for your car. Okay, so that's pretty obvious. The tree blocks light. But what's a little less obvious is that a tree is a natural air conditioner. Water evaporates from leaf surfaces. The conversion of water to air vapor removes heat energy from the air. This evaporation can have the cooling effect of many window unit air conditioners. Oh, and we talked about shade. Did you know you can improve the efficiency of your heat pump by shading it with a tree? And remember, there's two different kinds of trees, evergreen and deciduous. If you plant deciduous trees, you're going to block all that excess heat and glare during the summer but lit it through in the winter when you really could use a little pick-me-up from sunlight. And what about a couple other benefits? Trees absorb and block noise. They help settle dust, pollen, and smoke from the air. And they absorb carbon dioxide and other gases and release oxygen. We've talked mostly about the summer, but what if you live in a really cold, windy area where the wind pulls the heat away from the house during the wintertime? Well, think about a wind block of evergreen trees that can reduce wind speed and therefore reduce the loss of heat from your home by as much as 10 to 50%. And of course, just having trees around is soothing and beautiful and restful on the eyes. I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
Thanks for listening to the Down East Journal. Have a great weekend.